Well, thank you very much, Rickard, for inviting me, and it's a great honour and pleasure to be here in an institute which I know for 30 years and where I've often worked in its wonderful library. And the subtitle of my talk tonight could be Tales of the Unexpected, because I want to stress how surprising Ottoman diplomatic history is when it's not seen in terms of conflict. And so it's a general survey highlighting some aspects of the always dramatic relations between the powers of Europe and the Ottoman Empire. And as you see from the map, the Ottoman Empire was an essential part of Europe. Istanbul was both seat of the caliphate and, in the mixture of peoples, languages and embassies in the streets outside, a great European capital. There's an ancient Turkish proverb, the Turk has no friend but the Turk, but that's just a sort of negotiating point. In reality, the Ottoman Empire always had European friends. It rose thanks to one ally from Europe and fell thanks to another. 20th century nationalism de-Europeanized Ottoman history and de-Ottomanized European history. And in our global age, it is time to redress the balance. And in reality, Ottoman soldiers first crossed into Europe as allies of either the Byzantine Emperor Cantacuzinos or the Republic of Genoa. And Mehmed II, the conqueror of Constantinople, allowed the Genoese of Galata to remain in their section of Istanbul, just down the road below the tower, as I'm sure you know. And he was an ally, in addition, of Florence, and discussed policy with and was entertained to dinner by Florentine merchants in Galata. And after peace in 1479, relations with Venice became sufficiently relaxed for the Sultan to ask the Doge to find him a competent painter. And there is the result. Gentile Bellini's portrait of the Sultan in a Renaissance frame, framed as a Renaissance prince, painted in Istanbul in 1480, today in the V&A in London. So at this stage, Istanbul was closer to the Italian Renaissance than London. There is no such Venetian picture of King Edward IV. And the Ottoman Empire was in fact nearer to Europe than to Asia. The relations of the sultans with other Muslim monarchs, such as the Shah of Persia or the Mughal Emperor, were frequently hostile. Embassies were exchanged, but they were never permanent. The Shah was hated as a Shia heretic and feared as a rival for territory in the Caucasus and what is now Iraq, the same areas which provoked disputes in the Iran-Iraq War in 1980. And in India, the Mughal Emperor, conscious of his descent from Timurlenk, the enemy of the Ottomans, challenged the Sultan's claim to be sole caliph and asylum of the universe. And another barrier was the length of the journey, 6 to 9 months between Delhi and Constantinople. In contrast, the journey between Venice or Marseille and Constantinople took between 2 to 6 weeks, relatively short time for those days. And of course, the Ottoman Empire ruled a crucial area strategically and geographically and religiously for the powers of Europe. It included the holy city of Jerusalem, which was a pilgrimage centre right down to the 20th century, and the great ports and trading cities of the Levant, like Aleppo and Izmir. And all these factors made the urge to have peaceful relations with the Ottoman Empire more important than the urge to holy war. In 1639, a Venetian ambassador threatened the Ottoman government with the anger of Christendom. The Grand Vizier's deputy replied, "You make me laugh when you try to frighten me with the forces of Christianity. It is an illusion with nothing terrible except its name." And Istanbul became one of the diplomatic capitals of Europe. Permanent embassies were established there in the 16th century, at roughly the same time that they were being established in other European capitals. Venice, Genoa, France, the Emperor, Poland. Only Spain was a real crusading power which didn't have diplomatic relations with the Ottoman Empire. But even King Philip II of Spain himself would send secret agents here to arrange truces. And these embassies were mainly, more or less, where the consulates are today, the Italian, French, and Dutch, and Swedish consulates. And Istanbul became, from the 16th century, in the words of one French diplomat, the Vicomte de Marcellus, a centre of minuscule and complicated negotiations such as do not exist in other political capitals. And a later visitor called William Miller put it more simply. In Constantinople, one is never finished with a piece of business. What is simple elsewhere is complicated here. And Istanbul, more than Venice, was Europe's window on the Ottoman Empire and the Muslim world, and vice versa. And most ambassadors, there were threats to ambassadors. When war broke out, ambassadors were put in the prison of the Seven Towers, but they did in fact all emerge alive. Of course, they didn't know they would. And the meetings of ambassadors and grand viziers appeared to be collisions between two worlds. They wore different costumes, they spoke different languages, they followed different religions. In reality, these collisions were also conjunctions. Through their interpreters, they spoke a common language of monarchy, money, and status, and they related to each other through what are now called cultural universals, i.e. dress, space, and the number of people in your entourage. And there was a ceremony which I call caftanning the ambassador. Here you see, it's a picture, one of the earliest pictures of a Western ambassador, Sigmund von Herberstein. It's now, I think, in the castle of Ptuj in Slovenia. He's an imperial ambassador in the 16th century, and this picture commemorates his embassy to Istanbul. Because when you entered the Sultan's presence, as you were allowed to at the beginning of your embassy, you were incorporated in the dress code of the empire, and dressed with the key status marker of all time, really, almost down to our own day. Dress implied that the ambassador and his suite were guests under the Sultan's protection, or perhaps, for some people, tributaries. Here you see the French ambassador in 1724. He and his suite and his sons, they are wearing Western wigs, a Western hat, but an Ottoman kaftan. That's in the throne room in Topkapi, the same room that you can visit today. And ambassadors judged their success by the number and splendour of the kaftans they were given. And an ambassador would refuse to proceed from his meeting room with the Grand Vizier to the throne room of the Sultan until he had sent one of his own servants ahead to an adjoining vestibule to report how many kaftans and of what quality had been assigned to him. And only when they had put on their kaftans were European ambassadors admitted to the Sultan's throne room. And they became symbols of their country's shared interests with the Ottoman Empire. And this keeping of the hats was a key religious indicator that they weren't Muslims. So there was an Ottoman use of the word hats as shorthand for Europeans. In the 17th century, ambassadors generally received about 40 kaftans. An exceptionally important ambassador, such as an ambassador extraordinary of the Holy Roman Empire, also obtained a sable cloak. So it's the language of dress showing honour and alliance. In 1724, the French ambassador reported that he received 42 kaftans for members of his embassy, and his dragoman assured him they were of richer material than those usually distributed to ambassadors, and similar to those worn by the Grand Vizier himself. Dress was the language, the bargaining counter of power, and then often these kaftans were then sold back by the embassy to middlemen who then of course sold them back to the Ottoman government for use for the next embassy. And the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in its war of 1768 to 74 against Russia was reflected in the status of ambassadors. After 1772, every ambassador began to receive a sable cloak and ermine coats and more kaftans for lesser officials. But embassies were not just embassies. They were also centres of information. They were also research centres, like where we are now. In the 1550s, for example, in an interval of peace between the Holy Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire, the imperial ambassador, Bilal de Buzbek, was buying Greek manuscripts from the Sultan's doctor for the imperial library in Vienna, some are still there, and his own letters, Buzbek's letters, although much reworked at a later date and incorporating topoi from all sorts of sources, they are free of what Edward Said has called the essence of Orientalism, the distance between Western superiority and Oriental inferiority. They in fact exaggerate the power and virtues of the Ottoman Empire in order to criticize his own society, and are less hostile than many contemporary Western accounts of other Western countries. He praises, for example, the discipline of the Ottoman army and its career open to the talents, according to him. And this is print of Suleiman the Magnificent is by an artist in his entourage, Melchior Lorix, whose drawings are in Copenhagen now. And that is, apologise for the quality, that is part of Lorix's panorama of Constantinople, showing the Suleimaniye Mosque. And one version of this panorama would hang in the Great Hall of the University of Leiden in the 17th century. And this is another picture of another imperial ambassador. This is the 1630s. It's in a castle in Lower Austria called Greilenstein for Baron von Kufstein. And I think it's an ex voto of thanks to the Virgin for safe return from Istanbul, where he was in 1634. And there's about 12 of these pictures hanging in the Türkensaal of this castle. And it's by no means the only Türkensaal among the castles of Germany. There's one of the princes of Oettingen, but I haven't managed to get that. An embassy to Constantinople was so spectacular, so rewarding, so imposing, that you commissioned pictures if you had the opportunity to take back home and impress your family and relations and raise your own status in your own society. And in fact, these embassies were miniature courts, centres of news, protection, hospitality, information exchange, as I said, and adjudication. They all had their own law courts to judge their own citizens under the capitulations. That's such a vast subject, I won't talk about it tonight. But you can see the law court of the French embassy still behind the Palais de France now, with the symbols of the scales of justice on the outer wall. And such was their legal powers. I believe that on occasion they had the power to inflict capital punishment too. And in the evening, in the streets of Pera, ambassadors would visit each other in royal state, escorted by their own guards, running footmen with torches, and I quote, a numerous train of attendants and servants. They are particularly scrupulous in observing the forms which have been established to distinguish their different degrees of rank and precedency, and according to the number of times a bell tolls, it announces an ambassador, an envoy, or a chargé d'affaires. And Istanbul was so important as a testing ground for career diplomats that ambassadors here often became foreign ministers back in their own capital later. for example, Thugut of Austria, Kuhlmann of Germany, and the future and the great Comte de Vergennes, whose portrait is on the poster for tonight, a future French foreign minister and founding father of the United States. He was ambassador here from 1756 to 1768 and was greeted by the Sultan on his arrival audience in a rare, usually the Sultan didn't deign to say much, as representative of, quote, the oldest and the most faithful ally of the Ottoman Empire. And he would write how my style of life is superior to that of any ambassador. Never has the palace of France been better decorated than it is. My table is served for 14 gentlemen every day. And I now want to talk about, go country by country, the countries which had permanent embassies here. And this is another picture which has just appeared on the market. It shows a meeting in 1625 in Transylvania between Ottoman envoys and envoys of the Prince of Transylvania. Transylvania is one of those countries on the fringes of the empire which paid tribute but retained its own independence. Transylvania, Moldavia, Wallachia, and the city-state of Dubrovnik. All its buildings now talk about the free city-state, the free Republic of Dubrovnik. No museum in Dubrovnik mentions the fact that it was an Ottoman tributary for 300 or 400 years. There's that picture again, showing a banquet in Transylvania of Ottomans and Transylvanians. And Venice, even when it was at war with the Ottoman Porte, this is Barbaro, the bailo of Venice in 1570 at the time of the Lepanto War, but he maintained friendly relations with the Grand Vizier Sokolu Mehmet Pasha. I think he's shown in the prison of the Galata Tower, but he got out alive and subsequently returned to Venice. And later, the Venetian embassy is also a cultural centre. The best book on the Ottoman army and navy, L'état militaire de l'Empire Ottoman, by Count Luigi Ferdinando Marsigli, was written when he was staying at the Venetian embassy in 1679-80, and his work was based on Ottoman records and contacts with intellectuals such as Hussein Hezarfen. There is Marsigli holding some of his documents. It's a wonderful piece of book production with excellent illustrations and maps. And a Venetian diplomat here, Donado, wrote the first study of Ottoman literature in a Western language, De la Letteratura di Turchi, in 1688. And that is a view of the Bosphorus taken from the Palace of Venice in 1740, done by some military engineers. Please note how many ships are on the Bosphorus. Its role as a great commercial city was also important. And in the late 17th century, more books on Ottoman literature were written by Venetians. There was a Venetian botanist called Spallanzani staying at the embassy, and a painter called Tognoli, and he wrote that he lived for years alla splendida corte di sua eccellenza Agostino Garzoni, bailo veneto alla porta ottomana. But the most important country of all was France, and this is a text from the capitulations for France of 1740, recently displayed at a wonderful exhibition in Versailles about the treasures of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which showed just how freely it could run itself and maintain its treasures through 300 years or more that Jerusalem was under Ottoman rule. As I'm sure many of you know, there was an alliance because both France and the Ottoman Empire were enemies of the House of Austria. François Premier, in prison after the Battle of Pavia in 1725, sent a letter pleading for help to to Suleiman the Magnificent. And the Ottoman attack on Hungary a year later may have been an early strategic response. And the Ottoman, the first permanent French ambassador, arrives in 1536. He arranges for French ships to refit in the port of Constantinople, as Ottoman ships refitted in Toulon in 1543, and he helps instruct Ottoman artillery against Persia in 1548-50, and to organise joint French-Ottoman naval operations in the 1550s in the Mediterranean against Spain. So it's some alliance, it's a fully functioning military as well as political alliance. And one French noble called it the Union of the Lily and the Crescent, and it lasted until the French invasion of Egypt in 1798. Treaties were printed in Ottoman. French ambassadors would correspond with the Janissaries, speculate in the Ottoman grain trade, wear Ottoman dress, even in the French embassy, and of course they would call their sons Constantine if they were born in Constantinople. And there's no formal written alliance. It's rather like today, as Turkey asks to join the European Union and is constantly rebuffed or told try again later. The French government doesn't have a written alliance, but every ambassador talks about it. Comte de Guirard in 1679, for example, arrived with instructions to preserve the alliance which has existed for a long time between the two greatest and most powerful empires in the world. And the alliance was so powerful, like an old marriage, that it could resist minor troubles like Algerian ships attacking French ships, or Louis XIV sending French troops to help Venice in Crete. And indeed, probably the Ottoman Empire did not know that the King of France had taken under his protection all the Catholics, all the Maronites in what are now Syria and Lebanon in 1639. And that's the origin of the alleged French protectorate over Catholics, which survives to today in Jerusalem. And the French-Ottoman alliance, that's a privilege given to the Church of Jerusalem. That is one of the vestments given by King Louis XIII in 1626, which survives to this day, owned by the confraternity of the Franciscans who administer the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Unbelievable quality of embroidery, which there is almost no other Ancien Régime equivalent in France, because everything was destroyed in the Revolution. The complete effect of these vestments in a room in Versailles this summer was simply staggering. And in addition to the vestments, the silver and the gold survive also, given by the King of France, the King of Naples, the Holy Roman Emperor, and so on. Zealots on both sides disliked this alliance, both Catholics and some Muslims. So a legend was created that the mother of Mehmed II had been a daughter of a King of France. Completely untrue, but convenient. And I'd like to quote what a Grand Vizier, according to the French ambassador, said in 1724. France had recently mediated a peace treaty between the Ottoman Empire and Russia. The Grand Vizier suggested a triple French-Ottoman-Russian alliance to the Vicomte d'Andrezel at his audience in Topkapi Palace. And he said, quote, "The Empire of France had for an infinite time been linked by a close friendship with the gate of felicity, which was linked to eternity. The affairs of France and our affairs are common, and if there is any difference between us, it is only in religion, only religion. One of our first sultans married a princess of the royal blood of France. He then gave 1,000 blessings to Louis XV, wishing him a reign as long and fortunate as that of Louis XIV. Thus, at moments, the Ottoman Empire could present itself as part of that family of kings, which was one of the forces uniting the states of Europe." There were many, many French travellers staying in the French embassy who wrote more books on the Ottoman Empire than on any other area in Europe except Italy in French, and certainly more than on the recently discovered continent of America. For example, Nicolas de Nicolaï, Piton de Tournefort, the botanist, and Antoine Galland, the a traveller who knew Ottoman scholars, and he's the first translation of the Thousand and One Nights was made in the French embassy, so Parisians could read translations of that 60 years before the first French translations of the plays of Shakespeare. And reflecting France's role as the Ottoman Empire's most constant ally, French ambassadors also most frequently commissioned pictures of the city. And their principal artist was Jean-Baptiste Van Moor. And there have recently been exhibitions of him here. He arrived in 1699 in the suite of the French ambassador at the age of 28 and stayed here until 1737, when he died and was buried in Saint-Benoît. And many, many pictures, and the science of Van Moorology is in its infancy. There's so much was produced. No one has really established a proper corpus of what's by him, what's by his studio, what's by students. I'll show you a few. This is a view of the arrival of an ambassador. No, it's the Sultan's procession. Maybe a fantasy outside Istanbul. Here is a picture of the Venetian Bailo, recognizable by his strange hat, in his procession arriving in Istanbul with the aqueduct of Valens in the background. You had to have a very grand procession if you were an ambassador worth your pay. A lot of footmen, a lot of costumes, a lot of accompanying diplomats, travellers, and so on. A lot of escorting Ottoman footmen, janissaries, and so on. And everybody, at any rate, diplomats said so. Everybody is counting how many janissaries you're assigned, and so on. And here he is again. These pictures are in the Musée de Pera, the Venetian Bailo. It's about 1726. He is advancing through the second courtyard, followed by Venetians of his embassy or any Venetian traveller who happens to be in the city, preceded by two interpreters, one for him, one for the Ottoman government, and two Ottoman court officials. And this famous moment, where it's the janissaries' payday, the ambassador's audience has to coincide with a payday to have a number of janissaries and allegedly their uniforms and discipline impressed the visiting ambassador. And this is the Dutch ambassador Cornelis Kalkern in 1727. Exactly the same occasion, the janissaries' payday, a large number of people in his suite. And he lived here for many years. He's used as a source of information by the Ottoman government, including some of the first fire engines coming from Amsterdam here. And he is famous in Holland because, by his will, the pictures he commissioned from Van Moor, who worked for other ambassadors as well as the French ambassador, had to stay together, and they were for a long time in the Levant room in the town hall of Amsterdam, and they are now in the Turkish cabinet in the newly reopened Rijksmuseum. I well recommend a visit, because you're transported back to Istanbul in the 1720s. And this is another ambassador. You see, this is clearly school of Van Moor. It's a bit vaguer. And just as a detail, the courtyard has been given, the arches have been given two pillars. And in fact, they only have one in the background. And here we're in the Divan Hane, the room you can visit today. This is the Vicomte d'Andrezel. He's having an early meal, a sort of breakfast, with the Grand Vizier.
Ibrahim Nebshahirli Pasha. And the two interpreters on either side, the food is being brought. You can see the window through which the Sultan might be able to overhear the conversation, and side tables with other Dutch, other Frenchmen also having a meal. This is an early morning meal. He's had to wait outside as the Grand Vizier arrives, and then later on he'll be checking his kaftan and be introduced to the Sultan. And there are extraordinary records, not just of Ottoman-European intimacy and the honour paid to an ambassador. He's having a meal with the Grand Vizier, who's a semi-imperial figure, the absolute deputy of the Sultan. There's also a unique record of diplomatic ceremonial in general. There are various workshops being run now about diplomatic ceremonial, and there just are not equivalent pictures for Vienna or Rome or Paris. I think it shows the impact of Constantinople in Europe that these pictures exist. And here is the Venetian Bailo having his meal with the Grand Vizier, the same Grand Vizier were in 1726. And this is the audience of the Vicomte d'Andrezel's sons with the Grand Vizier in 1724. And he has a very large number of diplomats, local French merchants, or French travellers in the same room. They come along to look. It's a unique opportunity. In 1810, during the British ambassador's audience, Byron himself was part of his entourage to have a look. And because he was a peer, he thought he should have had a better place in the procession than he was given. And Van Moor didn't just paint grand ambassadors. He also was instructed by the French ambassador, the Comte de Ferriol, who we'll be coming to later, to paint all officials and races of the city in their respective costumes. So pictures survive in the Rijksmuseum, in the Turkish cabinet, of, for example, a court messenger, an Armenian martyr, a Turk cutting himself to show love for his mistress, a Jewish woman taking goods from harem to harem, a seller of clothes, Albanians, Bulgarians, Wallachians, and so on. And these were published in 1714 in a book called Recueil de Saint-Estampe représentant différentes nations du Levant. And so great was the appetite for knowledge of the Ottoman Empire, this book was quickly reprinted in French and translated into German, Italian, English, and Spanish. So it's the basic source book for Turquerie, or views of the French. And this is a local French merchant. He's wearing a sort of version of local dress, but he's kept his wig and hat to show he's a Christian. And this is the wall in the Rijksmuseum now of the different pictures of different trades and religions of Istanbul. You can see at the bottom, for example, a Bulgarian shepherd, or a lady from the Greek islands, or a dervish in the middle, and a black eunuch on the second row, and Ottoman officials on the top, including the Sultan himself. It's a staggering collection of pictures. And finally, the throne room. This is the supreme moment. And please note that the children of the Sultan are watching, and the children of the ambassador are present too. It's a sort of family occasion. And the kaftan is being worn. An interpreter is speaking to the Sultan. The Sultan is too grand to look at the ambassador. He's staring ahead. And the Grand Vizier is on the left. Though the Sultan, of course, did notice, and there's some rather marvellous remark of Mahmud II, when Byron is joining the Greek revolt in 1820, he says, "Oh yes, I remember him at the audience in 1810. He didn't look as if he had it in him," sort of remark. And the diplomats are being held under the arm in some cases as a security precaution, because once somebody admitted to an audience had attacked a sultan in the 14th century. And the Ottoman palace, the Ottoman court, the rules were no weapons allowed, and we'll come to that later. Of course, they show the honours presented to the ambassador. These are pictures commissioned by ambassadors. They don't show the way he was pushed down in front of the sultan to be very, very deep prostration. And some sources allege to touch the floor with his head, but I'm not sure about that. And there were many, of course, diplomats, human vanities concentrated into small spaces, lots of precedence wars, and of course they occurred in the reign particularly of Louis XIV. And I don't have time to tell them all. They're very illuminating insights into the psyche of the time. There was l'affaire du sofa, of whether the ambassador's stool could be on the sofa equal with the Grand Vizier when he's meeting him for negotiations or not. And one French ambassador, when Kara Mustafa Pasha is Grand Vizier, the Ottoman Empire is going through a period of folie de grandeur, and he hits the French ambassador on the head with his stool. Another ambassador, the messengers forced down his head so violently in front of the Sultan, 1671, the Marquis de Noindel, that he fell in front of the throne. But contrary to what a lot of people think, these are sort of ceremony wars. They could be kept separate from the real business of diplomacy. So there's disputes, but French capitulations were renewed on a favourable basis in 1673. And then finally, 1699, of course these wars weren't just between different governments, but also within embassies, within the diplomatic profession, and your real enemy was your colleagues or your predecessor. And one French ambassador in 1690 said he had worn a sword when he went to the Sultan's throne room. It was probably a lie, but it's probably to force his successor to insist on the right to wear a sword. It's a typical trick. This is the Comte de Fabiol, the great cultural patron of Vanmoor. He arrives, 1699, audience with the Sultan on the 5th of January, 1700. He insisted on wearing a sword, as if he's a courtier at Versailles, although no one in the Ottoman palace, not even the Grand Vizier, appeared armed in the presence of the Sultan. So there's a great drama. The Sultan has come specially from Edirne for this audience with the ambassador of his great ally. The Grand Dragoman, Mavrocordato, who typically, he's a great figure of the Greek revival. He's serving the Ottoman Empire as interpreter, but he's also planning the downfall of the empire and writing papers about it. At the same time, he's negotiating the treaty ending war with Austria. The Grand Dragoman, in a trembling voice, requested the French ambassador to remove his sword. The French ambassador swore he would fight to the last drop of his blood if anyone tried to remove it. The Grand Vizier himself, Amtshehzade Hussein Pasha, replied in the language of monarchy. So if monarchy is linking these two countries together. In well-regulated courts, such an usurpation of ceremonial was not allowed. And for an hour, they are quarrelling in the vestibule between the second courtyard and the throne room. Many different high-ranking Ottoman officials assure Ferriol that no previous French ambassador had worn a sword. He replied that his life was a matter of indifference from the moment that the dignity of an ambassador and the execution of the orders of the King of France were at stake. Now, the Sultan is kept sort of waiting and presumably fuming on his throne. Finally, Ferriol is informed he will advance to the throne room, and in a vestibule, the chief doorkeeper swoops on him to remove the sword, and the ambassador hits him in the stomach
and shouts in indignation, "Is it thus that you violate the law of nations? Are we friends or are we enemies?" And trembling in fear and dismay, Mavrocordate whispered, "Friends, but you cannot enter with your sword. You must adapt to the ceremonies and manners in the country where you are." And finally, the ambassador left. He and his suite took off their caftans. They took back the presents they had brought, a clock in the mirror, and they returned, sulking, to the French embassy, watched by the crowd of Istanbul. And until his departure, 11 years later, Ferriol never got his audience. But in fact, that didn't interrupt the alliance and links between the Ottoman Empire and France. That's the bailo in the throne room. You see the Sultan is staring ahead. The same rituals, the Sultan's sons being present as if they're sort of sharing sovereignty. Rather a small group of people with him. That is, I think, the imperial ambassador with the Sultan. And that is the Dutch ambassador, Kelkern, with the Sultan in the throne room. Whether Van Moor himself actually got into the throne room, it's a slightly fantastic representation, probably. But obviously he interviewed people and heard descriptions of it. He certainly got into the second courtyard as an artist. And this is the Sultan himself. And Van Moor's not just an artist of diplomacy and ceremonial. You see, he also paints Petrona Halil, the leader of the revolution of 1730, brandishing his sword in front of Topkapi Palace itself. So he's interested in the power structure and the politics of Istanbul. You see, he's an early ancestor. Again, dress is being used as a message because he's wearing deliberately disheveled dress. There he is again, as you see him in the Rijksmuseum now. And that is his murder on the Grand Vizier's orders a few months later in 1730. And the French relationship goes on. This is the French, the Ottoman embassy in 1741, one of the very few occasions when the King of France uses the Galerie des Glaces full effect to receive the Ottoman ambassador, Said Mehmet, who is shown in this portrait here. And he helped Ibrahim Mutafarika with his printing press. That is by Van Loo. And these contacts between the Ottoman Empire and its European friends weren't, of course, just diplomatic, strategic, political. There's also trade, commerce links the Ottoman Empire to the powers of Europe. The English embassy, 1579, the first ambassador, Harborne, is not just a diplomat, he's also a merchant. He imported lead, tin and cloth to Constantinople and exported wine and currants, and already the diplomatic service was partly privatized. His salary was not paid by Elizabeth I, but by the Levant Company, which he helped to found. French trade with the Ottoman Empire is enormous, particularly in the 17th century, said to keep half Provence alive. The French trade is called the Levant our Indies. The Comte de Saint-Priest, ambassador from 1768 to 1784, wrote, "At no time does the matter of French commerce allow the King's ambassador to relax the constant vigilance which he must pay to it." Trade begins Dutch-Ottoman relations in 1610, founded really by the Ottoman government's desire for a Dutch ambassador. A lot of letters coming from the Captain Pasha and the Sheikh of Islam, and of course they shared the same enemy, Spain. Capitulations were granted to the Dutch in 1612. They have a Levant company, and that is English traders in Aleppo. And here is the Dutch consul in Izmir being received by the Qadi and presenting the capitulations for renewal. This is about 1729.
You see the great trading port of Izmir in the back, which Dutch merchants had helped to connect to the commerce of the world. Izmir becomes this huge commercial city, trading from Boston to Jakarta. The Dutch were very good at getting Turkish opium to keep the subjects quiet in Indonesia. And he's Monsieur de Hochepierre, he's of a family which were consuls in Izmir and sometimes ambassadors in Constantinople for three centuries, from the 17th to the 20th. And you see the flags on the waterfront of Izmir, a Dutch and a French flag, flying above the consulate, sort of saying, we're here and we're here to stay. And Dutch enterprise boosts Izmir, which was a very small port to begin with, exactly the same time that Dutch traders were settling in New Amsterdam, what is now New York, across the ocean. And for a very long time, Izmir was richer and larger than New York. There you see a French admiral's procession through the streets of Izmir, 1766. It's a sort of friendly visit to the local governor. You see, again, escorted by interpreters and janissaries. And it's a huge occasion, watched by people from the windows. Another friend of the Ottoman Empire. There you see Marseille, I'm sorry for the quality, Marseille, the great source of trade with Izmir. The Chamber of Commerce of Marseille ran French trade with the Ottoman Empire, and in the foreground you could see Greek and Turkish merchants who come to Marseille, but of course churches and synagogues flourish in the Ottoman Empire. No mosque was allowed in Marseille until the 20th century. And another friend, I mustn't talk too long, another friend was Poland. There was a treaty in 1533, of perpetual friendship and alliance between Poland and the Ottoman Empire. Suleiman the Magnificent said he was like two brothers with the King of Poland. And Polish embassies would make spectacular entries into Istanbul with heron plumes in their caps, military footmen, 300 nobles, priests and hussars. And the Grand Vizier commented, the embassy was too small to besiege Istanbul, but too large to kiss the threshold of the Sublime Porte. He feared it would be soiled by the contact of so many Christian lips. And he added, the Sultan will have no difficulty in feeding 300 Poles when he already owned 3,000 Polish galley slaves. Of course, there is the John Sobieski intervening in the siege of Vienna, but soon after, peaceful relations resume, and the Ottoman Empire was deeply concerned with the fate of Poland, because of course it was alarmed by Russian expansion. There's a Polish saying, Poland will not be free again until the Sultan's horses are watered in the river Vistula. And indeed, in 1768, the declaration of war on Russia by the Ottoman Empire was partly to get Russian troops out of Poland. The Ottoman Empire is the only European power which really protested and long refused to acknowledge the partition of Poland. And this shows, as a reflection of that relationship, Polish national dress was influenced by Ottoman dress. And there's a portrait showing it. And this is King Stanislaus Leszczynski, who had lived in the Ottoman Empire when Charles XII of Sweden, his ally, was living on Ottoman territory. He's a Polish noble who supported the Ottoman alliance. He later goes into exile. His daughter marries Louis XV, and he is given the Duchy of Lorraine to rule, and he filled Lorraine with Turkish kiosks made of wood. Unfortunately, none of them survive, but they were illustrated in print. And here he is in a version of Turkish dress. It's hanging in the Chateau of Chambord. Probably the artist has imitated the dress from Van Moore's prints. And the Polish-Turkish relationship went on through the 19th century. We'll come to that later. And travellers also link Europe and the Ottoman Empire. Here is an early English traveller, John Montague. He writes a very good book on the Ottoman Empire, Observations on the Ottoman Empire. And he's beginning the tradition of travelling the Ottoman Empire to equip yourself for high office later. He becomes First Lord of the Admiralty and a significant political figure. He's bought his Turkish dress on his travels, and he's painted in it in a studio back in London. He probably didn't look like that when he was travelling here. And he founds a sort of a Turkish club, a divan club, in 1740 back in London. And he called himself Sheikh Pyramidal. And he brought with him the great portraitist Lyotard, who lives in Istanbul, 1738-42. And there you see Lyotard's picture. It's either a Grand Vizier or a Captain Pasha, I think. And I wonder who it is. And it implies that that he's sitting in front of the painter. But the picture hasn't yet been fully researched. And there is Lyotard's drawing of Bonneval, who's a French officer who has come to live in Istanbul. He's called Bonneval Pasha, and he helps modernize some technical aspects of the army. Lyotard's picture of the imperial ambassador Count von Ulfeldt in 1740. You see he's wearing Viennese court costume, but you see in the background the interest in Ottoman textiles and embroidery. And that is a Lyotard drawing, and you wouldn't imagine who it is. It is Madame Adelaide, a daughter of Louis XV, dressed as a Turkish woman, because it's fashionable at Versailles in the 18th century. There's a similar portrait of Madame de Pompadour. And in the 18th century, as the Ottoman Empire gets weaker, it's clearly lost the 1768 war with Russia, then the French alliance becomes more important. This is Vergennes, the great French ambassador. It's painted by Fabre, a French artist living in his embassy for many years, and he's shown as an Ottoman with the great black fox fur coat, which was the most prized of all furs in the Ottoman palace. And this picture, again, you can now see in the Musée de Péra, a few minutes away from here. It's been bought back for Turkey. That's his wife, Madame de Vergennes, born in France, who married a member of the Testa family. She long lived here in Istanbul. And his successor is the Comte de Saint-Priest, who is shown here being presented to a sultan by Fabre. That's the Dutch ambassador, Count van Dedem. The tradition of diplomatic pictures goes on. This is Saint-Priest negotiating with the Grand Vizier at the camp of Daoud Pasha. It's a very interesting view of an interior of an opulent Turkish tent. And he's becoming more important as the Russian threat gets bigger. France helps supply the Ottoman capital with food and fortify the forts of the Bosphorus. This is Saint-Priest by Casanova. This is not actually painted in Istanbul, negotiating a treaty with the Grand Vizier. And this is a picture, a popular print, showing a Janissary showing the Bosphorus to a Russian officer. So the message is, you're not going to get it. Or not yet, at any rate. And the intimacy of the French-Ottoman relationship goes on. this is Sir Robert Ainslie, the British ambassador, with the Grand Vizier, painted by Luigi Maia, the artist of the British Embassy, who also did at least 400 views of the Ottoman Empire, but that's another subject. Hopefully there'll be an exhibition here soon. This is the next French ambassador, Choiseul Gouffier, the Comte de Choiseul Gouffier, who travelled around the Ottoman Empire in preparation for his career. He is a professional Philhellene, in fact, but quite a good ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. And he arrived in 1784 with about 100 technical advisors, engineers, writers, priests, a full staff. That is a view of Constantinople by one of his artists called Louis-François Cassas. And here, much more interesting to historians, here is a printed book explaining naval manoeuvres, the latest French views on naval manoeuvres for Ottoman officers, because French advisors are advising the navy, construction of ships and instructions of officers. The navy came before the army. Here you see Choiseul Gouffier in the Grand Vizier's kiosk, painted by Lépinasse, being received by the Sultan. And 1788, France is still an ally of the Ottoman Empire, and another war breaks out with Russia. And now another great power, which was long an ally of the Ottoman Empire, fights on the same side as the Ottoman Empire, and that is Sweden. And as we speak, the destiny of 100 pictures of 18th century Istanbul in a Swedish collection belonging to the Celsing family is hanging in the balance. The Celsings want to sell them. This collection has been kept together for 300 years. It's views of the city. I don't have time to show them all. Views of parties on the Bosphorus, a family tree of Ottoman sultans literally growing on a tree. And you see this view of the summer at Büyükdere, already embassies are beginning the tradition of spending the summer up the Bosphorus at Büyükdere or Tarabya. And the Swedish embassy produced probably the principal monument, cultural monument to Istanbul embassies, which is Tableau Général de l'Empire Ottoman, the frontispiece is on the right. It's by the Armenian Catholic interpreter of the embassy called Muradja Dostum, and it's published in Paris, probably at the expense of the French government. And it's a call for reform, for Ottoman reform, and reforming Islam. It's a pro-Muslim book published in Paris in 1787. You see the frontispiece on the right shows the Prophet Muhammad in front of the Kaaba in Mecca. And the message of the book is that the Ottoman Empire isn't dead yet, can reform, and can win wars. And this book, which I recommend to you, has about 200 illustrations. The first picture of Mecca, surveys every aspect of the empire: religion, the palace, costume, government, army, the legal system, and even the imperial harem. Though Muradja said it was more difficult to find out information about that than about all the rest of the empire put together. And he called for a new Suleiman the Magnificent, who would, and I quote, maintain more intimate relations with the Europeans, adopt their tactics, in fact, absolutely change the face of the empire. And this book was dedicated to Gustavus III, King of Sweden, who is then fighting Catherine the Great with the Ottoman Empire. He even received money through Hamburg from the Ottoman Empire. And they're encouraged by France, but in fact the war, of course, doesn't go well. Sweden betrayed the alliance by signing a separate treaty with Catherine II in 1790, and Selim III, the modernizing sultan, the friend of the Choiseul Gouffier, commented, "Infidels are so unreliable." And the next great ally of the empire There you see Selim III. Already the portraits are beginning to be more personal. The next great ally of the empire was Britain. France invades Egypt in 1798. Britain and Russia then become friends of the empire in reaction. And there's a formal treaty, 1799. Russian ships, for the only time ever, Russian battleships arrived through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles. And Lord Nelson himself is given, you see, top right on his shoulder, the Order of the Crescent, a sort of fantasy order invented to please Europeans, and a jewelled aigrette in his hat, given to him by the Sultan in gratitude for the Battle of the Nile and the expulsion of the French from Egypt. And Nelson was a vain man. He wore these orders and this aigrette at the Battle of Trafalgar, and that is one reason why it was so easy for a French marksman to pick him up. So the Ottoman alliance killed him. And throughout the Ottoman, throughout the 19th century, England is the principal ally of the Ottoman Empire. There you see Stratford Canning, as he then was, with the Grand Vizier, I think. A picture from Stratford Canning's own collection, which is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum. There you see Mahmud II, the great reforming sultan, the butcher of the Janissaries. He's threatened by rebellious pashas like Ali Pasha of Yanina, painted in 1819, but his rebellion is stopped. And of course by Kavalallah Mehmed Ali Pasha, who's shown here in Alexandria in 1839. But his main support, in addition to the continued strength of the Ottoman Empire itself, whose demise was constantly predicted but never really happened until after 1914, his main strength, one of his strengths, was European allies. Austria also emerges as an ally. Metternich says, "The Ottoman Empire was one of the most essential counterbalances in the equilibrium of Europe. He will defend the interests of the Porte as the most direct and most precious interest of Austria itself." And the Austrian ambassador gave advice on internal reform as well as external diplomacy. Britain and Austria helped defeat Muhammad Ali's attempt to take Syria and possibly Anatolia also in 1839-40. You see Muhammad Ali on the left, Abdul Majid the Sultan, his suzerain, on the right, painted by David Wilkie. The Crimean War is fought. Turkey, England and France, who are fighting for the independence and integrity of the Ottoman Empire against Russia. And here you see the camp of the British guards in front of Istanbul. These vast numbers of foreign troops going through Istanbul in the 1850s, and yet it is such a adaptable or well-administered or multinational city that it can absorb them, and troops rollicking around the streets outside, and there's no massive disturbance. And indeed, in the 19th century, Istanbul is becoming more of a world city, more of an international city. Many people immigrate to Istanbul, Poles, Hungarians, Germans, the great Turkish poet Nazım Hikmet, Nigar Hanım, the first lady poet, is descended from Hungarian immigrants into Istanbul, as well as Turks. And Nazım Hikmet is descended from Polish immigrants, Konstantini Borzeki, who came to the Ottoman Empire and was transformed into Mustafa Celaleddin Pasha, an Ottoman general. And it was convenient, his Polish ancestry, because when he's in exile in Russia, he was given Polish citizenship by the Polish communist government. And the last, many Italians also came here, and among them was the painter Fausto Zonaro, who was the darling of the embassies. He arrived in
1891, and in 1896 he becomes painter to His Imperial Majesty the Sultan. And one of the pictures he did, we've come full circle, is a copy of Bellini's portrait of the great ancestor, because that had long left Istanbul and Abdulhamid wanted a copy. There is Abdulhamid, who didn't like being painted, but this is probably painted in the few months between 1908 and 1909, when he's a constitutional monarch at the end of his reign. And he did paint this picture for Abdulhamid. It's called The Charge. It shows an Ottoman victory in the war with Greece in 1897. And of course, it's hung in the room of the ambassadors in Dolmabahçe Palace, just to show there's still a lot of fight in the Ottoman Empire. And he also painted 1898, this famous picture of the arrival of the Kaiser William II at Dolmabahçe Palace with his wife. You see the palace, the kayak, the mosque, and in the background the German embassy, the present consulate. And this is the Kaiser outside Chalet Koskou in Yildiz. And this great final alliance of the Ottoman Empire is with Germany itself. Military aspect. Here is Marshal von Bieberstein, the great ambassador in Istanbul. You see, I think there's a dueling scars. Very capable German ambassadors in Istanbul. And generals in the Ottoman army. Here you see Liman von Saunders with Mustafa Kemal on the right. Liman von Saunders is very much in control. And his position as commander of the Ottoman army on the Bosphorus, appointed in 1913 by the Young Turk government, so infuriated the Russian government, which A, wanted Istanbul, and B, more and more trade is passing through the Bosphorus, that meetings began to be held in St. Petersburg, February 1914, planning to seize Istanbul. The First World War was in part a war between Russia and Germany for control of the Straits. And this is Enver Pasha, military attaché in Berlin, leader of the Young Turk government, painted by Zonaro, the Sultan's court painter, who immediately switched to painting revolutionaries who overthrew the Sultan. And passionately pro-German, he wanted war, and is he, more than any other person, who brings the Ottoman Empire into war in 1914. So this last great alliance with Germany is in fact a fatal alliance, because it helps destroy the Ottoman Empire and brings an end not only to the empire, but to the presence of European embassies in Istanbul, which had helped make it a great European city as well as the Ottoman capital. Thank you very much.